Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 131. I'm recording it on Tuesday, April 28th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com website. And the title of this selection is Not Quite Tops of the Pops. The title of the podcast is Triumph of the Marketers. That title comes from a book, somewhat famous book. I haven't read it, but heard a lot of references to it. It's an expensive book, entitled Triumph of the Optimist. I think you could probably find it on Amazon. I imagine, years ago I looked at it and it was there, but I don't know about today, but I imagine. But my understanding is the primary content of the book is that it was a listing of records of different stock markets. And I without having read the book, my understanding is that the theme is sort of that there are these bleak periods, but in the end, the stock market does well because society does well. You know, triumph of the optimist. In other words, have confidence, have faith, and you'll end up doing well. But the benefit of the book is it gives you all the data to confirm that. Now, I to a large extent I agree with that, and I think that's why I'm largely pro stock. If you asked me on a continuum, you know, how pro stock is Rob Bennett, I'd say it's probably a 7 or an 8. More pro-stock than most, not quite as pro-stock as some, but of course I question whether the ones who claim to be the 9s and 10s, I don't want to say sincere, they believe they are pro-stock, but their behavior doesn't really match the belief. They do believe it themselves, but there's inside they have doubts, and the doubts is what caused the dogmatism. And dogmatism to me is a sign of fear. Dogmatism to me is a sign of a lack of confidence. So when I see dogmatism, I generally subtract points. So under that, you know, from my way of looking at things, and every single person is biased, from my way of looking at things, I'm among the most pro-stock you can be. So in that sense, I would fit in with that title, Triumph of the Optimist. I'd be classified as an optimist. And I'd be classified as someone who tells people, believe that in the end, the optimist will triumph. Don't let your fears stop you. Don't let your fears hold you back. And that's an important message in today's environment where we're hearing so much doom and gloom. So I very much want to be aligned with that school of thought. On the other hand, I am not a person who believes in... I am a person who believes, the way I often say it is, I'm a person who believes in the reality principle, which means I don't believe in putting your head in the ground and saying, the historical data doesn't mean anything just because passive investing's always led to bone-crushing losses every time it's been tried in the past. It might work this time. You never know. It could work. No, that's not Rob Bennett. That, to me, is not really optimism. That, to me, I don't know what I want to call it, but... self-delusion. And I don't go for self-delusion. So I believe that both the run, I believe the run, I believe the run, I believe there's too much focus on all the numbers. There's too much focus on the part of all the, you know, we're trying to analyze stocks, trying to understand how stocks work, what we should do with our money. And we are all scared. I believe each and every one of us is scared. That's why they call investing, they say it's all about risk. What risk really is being scared of something and then doing it anyway. And that's why you get rewarded. That's why stocks provide such great returns, because stocks are scary. If they weren't scary, they wouldn't provide good returns. So if somebody tells you I can make stocks not scary, it can't be true. There's got to be something scary about them or they won't work. And you've got to overcome your fear or you won't participate in the gains. So to me, all of stock analysis is about, you know, how do I overcome my fear? And part of that, I think, is facing it. See, that's where I differ from a lot of the big name experts. The big name experts say the way to, they don't say this, I'm characterizing them. But if you endorse passive investing, the way you're dealing with the fear is you're saying, ignore the fear. Don't worry about that fear. Oh, that's nothing. Yeah, just ignore that. You know, you've got a lion, you know, growling in the corner, and he's saying, just walk right on by. That lion's not going to do anything to you. And I think this is foolhardy behavior and dangerous and reckless and irresponsible behavior. The lion is overvaluation. Overvaluation has always crushed stock investors all through history, and the passive investing advocates have told us, oh, this time it's going to be different. And of course, it's never different. So I don't believe this. I don't believe the way to overcome the lion is by closing your eyes and pretending he's not there. I think the thing to do is to educate yourself about how to take on the lion, whether it means you need protective, you know, clothing, or whether you can tame the lion, or whether there's a different path you can take that the lion's not on. There's all sorts of possibilities, but you've got to come up with some way of getting past the lion, getting past your fear. Not ignoring your fear, getting past your fear, overcoming your fear. That's what it's all about at PassionSaving.com. It's about overcoming your fear, because when you overcome the fear, that's how you get rich. That's how you get financial freedom. That's how you retire early. And passive investing is a fairy tale, a lullaby telling you there's nothing to fear. And it's BS. And that's not, you know, that's to me is not triumph of the optimist. That's they would all hold that book up and say, oh, this proves we're right. But that's not really optimism. That's you know, telling fairy tales is not optimism. It's you know, I mean, frankly, it's deception. It may not be intentional deception. In most cases, I don't think it is, but it's deception, self-deception, and then it leads to deception of others inevitably. So we take a different path at PassionSaving.com. Now, but, so what I'm saying is I think of myself as the true optimist, the true stock lover. I love, you know, I love stocks in that stocks are, what I love about them though, you know, there was a time when I wouldn't have said that, I'd say stocks are boring. But what I love about stocks is the side of it that I focus on in all my writings and my podcast, that human side, that side of being afraid and taking up the challenge and overcoming it, that to me is exciting. And the fact that you get rewarded financially is exciting too, not because I care about dollar bills, because I care about all the life opportunities that open up as a result of that. And every podcast I do, I'm trying to understand, why are we so afraid? What's holding us back? Why have we allowed this passive investing fear talk to grind us down for three decades now? And, you know, we've now allowed it to cause millions of busted retirements. We've allowed it to cause destruction to our, you know, retire early and indexing discussion boards. We've allowed it to cause an economic crisis. Why? Why do we do this? And I focus on different levels. Sometimes I get down into the nitty gritty and talk about the numbers. And sometimes I take a big picture view. And I think the big picture view is that you can say that stock, the results of the stock markets, these were global stock markets that were examined in this book, not just one, not just US. I do think there's a story there about triumph of the optimist. But it's a drama. It's not, you know, if people put out that, they put out that book during a wild bull market. Now, if they put out that the book in a wild bear market, I guess that they'll say, no, it's not triumph of the optimist, it's triumph of the pessimist. They'll just look at the same data through the eyes of a pessimist, and they'll say, oh, the stock markets have always collapsed. They always go under. You know, it's always bad to be in stock. Humans can interpret things all kinds of ways. You see this in political debates. You know, you go to these blogs, you look at the liberal blogs, and it's all one way. You look at same development, you know, some simple development in the news, and they'll all take one approach, and you look at the conservative blogs, and they all take the other, and you're like, how do human beings look at the same event and come to such totally different conclusions about what it means, what it signifies? The answer is they've got their filter. They've got their liberal filter, and the other's got the conservative filter. And the passive investors apply a passive investing filter to everything they hear about the markets. And rational investors apply a rational investing filter. And optimists, you know, apply an optimistic filter. And pessimists apply a pessimistic filter. And for years now, we've been hearing this is triumph of the optimist. And of course, that makes you feel good. That makes you ignore the fears. But now that's changing. Now we're hearing the gloom and doom filter, and that's going to make you not ignore the fears, but ignore the opportunity. Just as bad, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So I think that what goes on is that because markets are comprised of people, the markets essentially reflect what's going on in the society. And societies always have challenges. There's never been a society that was heaven on earth. There's always challenges, there's always opportunities, there's always good, there's always bad. And the challenge that takes place at least in some general sense, is always going to mirror the challenge taking place in the society. And I think the word marketing hits at what the challenge is that we're facing today. I've often used this word. I when I refer to the passive investing dogmas, I refer to them as marketing slogans. And every time I do that, there's a little bell in my head that, you know, I just use as my guide. You know, I try to use my intellect in thinking through the things I talk about in the podcast, but I also use instinct. I also use intuition. And there's a little bell whenever I use that word marketing slogan that goes off and says, yeah, that's, you're on the right track with that one. Explore that one more. There's gold to be mined in that insight. Marketing slogan. And so this podcast, the purpose is to drill down a little bit, try to come to a little bit of a better understanding as to what the marketing angle is here. What the marketing angle is. Now, one of the things, there's another bell that goes off in my head. I'll start with this. One of the things I've done, you know, you'll hear a lot of talk about experts in my podcast, in my articles. I always put the, well, not always, but usually I put the word expert in quotes. Because the people, I argue that our knowledge of stock investing today is primitive. And the people we refer to as experts don't know nearly as much as they think they do, or nearly as much as we think they do. They're good people, they're smart people, but they're human, they're flawed, and they're scared. And so they try to pretend they know more than they do to sort of fake it. And that causes a lot of trouble. It causes all of our troubles, in my opinion. It causes all of our troubles. Well, one of the things that I've done, you know, one thing you have to do, and you know, I'm writing a book called Investing for Humans. At one point, you know, sort of near the end, probably the last chapter, if not close to it, you need to have a list of, what are my recommendations? How are we going to fix this? How are we going to change this? You know, or is this cycle just going to repeat? You know, you could argue this cycle of bull and bear markets just goes over and over again. Human nature never changes. We always destroy ourselves by telling ourselves valuations don't matter. And then our response to that is to get out of stocks altogether and swear never to get in again. We'll be so crushed at the end of this. We'll all just get out of stocks and it'll be 20 years before we invest again. And we'll miss out on all the wonderful returns that are available when stocks are priced reasonably. That's a cynical view of what's going on and not a stupid view. There's a lot of historical data supporting that. I don't ultimately buy into that, but it's I don't dismiss it. I can't dismiss it. There's too much evidence to dismiss it, but there's a part of me that this triumph of the optimist side of me that just says, no, I won't go there because if I go there, I can't record any podcast. It's all pointless. Yeah, what's the point? What's the point of being a journalist? Words can't help. People are doomed. People are what they are, and they're doomed. I don't think that. That's why I say I side with this triumph of the optimist side. Although I'm skeptical at times of being too, of giving into it too easily, I ultimately, that's where I come down. Well, one of the rules that I've come up with for how do we change things, how do we make things better, is we need to redefine what we mean by the word investing expert. Instead of what often we think of as an expert is someone who has strong opinions and is very sure of himself and has passed every test, and you know, he can tell you what to do with your money. Oh, he knows. And he's wealthy. He's made billions. And, you know, and I find this such a turnoff, this pompous, arrogant, know-it-all attitude. And it's characteristic of the passive investing school. Very characteristic. And, oh, I find it such a turnoff. And one of the rules I have for changing that is, of course, you can criticize the people who do it. And I do that. You know, I point that out. But if all I do is come along and say, oh, the passive investing experts are so bad because they're so arrogant, they're so full of themselves, well, how am I any different than them? You know, I'm just doing what they're doing from the other end. So there are two things I try to do. One, I try to present it in balance. If ever I'm going to say they do something bad, I try to match it by saying they do something good. You know, the ultimate case is John Bogle. He's the leading advocate of passive investing. So if I were going to draw a list of names of people responsible for this economic crisis, John Bogle's the first name on the list. However, he's also a person who taught me how stock investing works, and he's a person who has put forward probably more of the golden rules of how stock investing really works than anybody else I can name. So he's also one of the top names as people who help me understand the rational investing model. I don't put them quite at the top. I'd put Robert Shiller higher, and I'd put Rob Arnott higher, and I'd put John Walter Russell higher. But I'd put Bogle fourth, which is a high ranking. So that's balance. That's one way of not becoming a goon myself, is to provide balance. To, you know, I feel I have to criticize. If I don't criticize Bogle, or, you know, and I'm just using that as an example. But if I don't criticize Bogle, I'm not telling you how stock investing works, so can't do my job. So I have to criticize. But in order to make that criticism worthy in my eyes, and I hope in yours, but certainly in mine, I have to present it in a balanced way. Well, another thing I like to do is, how about turning the finger? Instead of pointing at others, how about turning the finger on myself? I've done that. I don't think often enough, but I've done it. You know, I've said, oh, I used to be a passive investor, and that's true. So all these things I talk about, this self-deception, deception of others, indifference, you know, recklessness, irresponsibility, get-rich-quick, you know, impulse, it all applies to Rob Bennett. I think that's helpful. When I do that sort of thing, that bell rings, and it says, yep, you're on the right track with this one. That's the way to go. That's different, but there's power there. So, that's one of the things I guess I want to tie this all to marketing. What I think is a big problem is that marketing. I don't know. Has marketing always been with us? I imagine marketing's always been with us in some form. People have, you know, we didn't have a marketing, we didn't have a you know, Madison Avenue industry, but yeah, I imagine even in earlier days, people always had to sell. You know, selling is just part of human life. You had to persuade. You had to sell. You had to present things in a positive light. You had to come up with, you know, catchy little slogans that sums everything up. Marketing's always been with us. But marketing today, I would argue, and I argue this somewhat tentatively, but I think I'm on the right track. Marketing today is it's almost dominant. It's like we are almost, you could almost say we are a marketing society. You know, some people say we're in the information age, or some people would say, you know, I don't know, we're in the age of democracy, or they'd say we're in the age of capitalism, these different things. But I think that it might be that what really is the driver of what is, it's not the driver of everything. There are other things going on. But the thing that is possibly most characteristic of today in human history is that marketing plays a bigger role in how we think and how we act than it ever has before. Now, I believe that before I even started writing about investing, I explore that theme a little bit in my book on saving, Passion Saving. So this is a, you know, I like it when there's a connection between the saving work and the investing work. And I'll give some examples. I first wanted to start with the example of, I wanted to point the finger at myself. I want to make clear here that when I say our behavior is determined by marketing, that I'm not just pointing fingers at others and saying, oh, those stupid people that, you know, listen to marketing slogans. It's not stupidity. It's not stupidity. And I think it helps if I can point, if I can think about ways I've done it, that helps me understand it. And if I verbalize those, hopefully it will help others because they won't feel that I'm pointing fingers at them. I'm pointing fingers at myself. The example I always bring up when I talk about marketing is Apple Computer. There's two kinds of computers, at least maybe there are more than two, but those are the two I always hear about, are the Windows-based computers and Apple. And Windows is the far bigger share of the market. I don't know. It's a huge percentage. 90%? I don't know. Roughly. I doubt that Apple has more than 10% of the market. And they're almost viewed as warring camps, you know. The people that like Windows will put down the people that like Apples. They'll say they're idiots. And the people that like Apples will put down the people that like Windows. They'll say they're Neanderthals, you know. And this goes back and forth. And clearly, these arguments are emotional. Now, you can always bring in intellectual arguments on both sides. And they always do that. And if you ask the participants, they'll say, oh, it's an intellectual argument. Apple's just better. Or, you know, the other side, it's an intellectual argument. Windows is just better. It's very parallel to the passive versus rational debate. But see, they're not really in the camp they're in because of the intellectual arguments. The intellectual arguments are after-the-fact rationalizations. They're in the camp they're in primarily for emotional / marketing reasons. People like Windows because they are Windows-type people. And people like... Now, of course, the average person doesn't care. The average person just sort of goes along. And since Windows is dominant, most people go with Windows. That's just, you know, most people don't care about these arguments. And the same thing's true with passive versus rational. When you go onto a discussion board, 80% of the community, they don't care about this. They just sort of want to hear what different people think. But the 20% who are the passive dogmatists, they are beside themselves if you allow a discussion of rationals. Cannot stand it. They hate rationals. And the rationals, I hope, don't feel that way about the passives, but the rationals do, of course, believe. The rationals do believe in their take and probably are influenced by emotion. If you're going to be objective about it, it's hard for me to see how it would be otherwise. So I sometimes ask myself, why do I like Apple Computer? I've always used Apples. And I like to think that I have enough self-honesty that I can acknowledge that while I think Apples are better, I could be wrong. In other words, I've had times, I mean, you know, their marketing pitch is just aimed right at me. It's just like somebody, you know, some marketing guy somewhere in a room said, I want Rob Bennett to buy this computer, so I'm going to make an entire advertising campaign aimed at him, and if anybody else buys in, that's fine, but we're going to get Rob Bennett, you know, for sure. The whole deal. And you know what the, you know, I don't need to go through it, but the marketing slogan that does it perfectly is they used to have would think different. And, you know, they'd have, I remember Bob Dylan was even one of their people that they had an ad. Bob Dylan, they had Mahatma Gandhi, Einstein, you know. But the idea of these people was they're different, you know, but they think different. They're different, but they're not different because they're in some weird way different. It's because they think different. And, you know, that's, you know, if I'm guilty of the sin of pride, and I certainly am, that's where my pride would be, that I think of myself as a person who thinks different. And of course, usually when people become prideful, there's something there. They don't just make it up. There's something about me that does think different. But usually when we are prideful, we exaggerate and we become unaware of our weak points. But the job of a marketing person is to appeal to the emotion. That's the job. They list the specifications. If you're looking to buy a computer, Apple will list the specifications. And when they list the specifications, they're not applying to your emotions. They're giving you facts. But the marketing guy's job is to take all those facts and sum them up in a marketing slogan, which doesn't sum up facts. It appeals to an emotion. See, our emotions and our intellect are connected. They're not, people think of them as being opposites. Like, you've got your emotions over here and your intellect over here, but they mesh at some point. We're integrated human beings. So our intellect supports our emotion, or our emotion supports our intellect, but they're not opposites. They ultimately have to mesh. And a marketing, when they say the phrase think different, it's two words, but it's like the title of a book. It's supposed to sum up everything within. You know, they've got specifications on, you know, this is the graphic display we have, and, you know, this is the, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you know, the music component, and, you know, a million things go into a computer. Thousands of people are working to design these computers, but the marketing guy takes all of that work and sums it up in two words: think different. And then that's what's supposed to grab the person's attention. And then if the person likes that slogan, then they read the specifications and they may choose the computer because it passed all their tests. But the eye-grabbing thing is the marketing pitch. And that's how we decide how to invest. The arch enemy of Rob Bennett is the passive investing school of thought. And the passive investing school of thought is a marketing pitch. It's not an academic study. There's no study that ever proved that passive investing is the right way to go. That is nonsense. I had a quote from Rob Arnott. I'm going to quote this one all the time. It's my favorite one. I don't know if I can quote it right off, but just the other day, this is just, I think I do have it. I have it written down here. This is Rob Arnott. The conventional wisdom of modern investing is largely myth and urban legend. Those are great words. That sums it all up, all, you know, 131 podcast in a few words. This passive investing stuff is urban legend. It's myth. It's not. Is there some sort of intellectual component to it? Of course. Are there actually studies they can point you to? Of course. But whether you believe those studies or whether you believe the conclusions they come to, that's all based on marketing. You can believe them if you choose, but they're not like studies in the sense that they're science. They're marketing pitches. The people who do them, you know, they consider themselves scientists, but they're really marketing people. I mean, you know, I used to work at one of the big consulting firms, and we would do revenue estimates for tax proposals. And a guy would come in and he'd say, I need a revenue estimate, and you try to find out, well, what do you need this for? You know, do you want this proposal to look good or bad? Do you want it to cost a lot of money or a little money? Do you want it? And you'd figure it out, and then you'd do your study showing. Well, surprise, surprise. The data shows just what the client wanted it to show. I mean, that's how we made our living. You know, the firm I worked at wasn't the only one doing that. I'm 100% sure. 100% sure. Were the people who did these quote-unquote studies honest people? Yes. They didn't break any laws. They went to school. They learned how to do this. They didn't outright lie. They spun. They spun. That's the game. You got to market your product, and you got to spin to do it. And I think we are in a marketing age. What I was going to say, you know, about Apple computer, that when I buy an Apple computer, though, it changes forever how I think about Apple versus Windows. What, you know, you start out just looking at that slogan, and then, of course, you start looking at the specs. And if the specs aren't good enough, you will abandon it. We are not purely marketing animals. We do have intellects, and we are rational to a degree, but we're not totally rational. It's just a lie to say we are. So we're brought in by the marketing pitch. We look at the specs, but then there's a critical point at which we say, okay, buy or not buy? Buy Apple or buy Windows? And boy, if you buy Apple, that's fine, but you're going to have you're going to be biased from that point forward because you've now spent, you know, $2,000 and you're not going to want to admit you made a mistake. So it's going to be harder from that point forward to see the other side of the story. It's going to be harder to become a Windows. Now, if Apple just is a miserable failure, you know, if the computer breaks on the second day and they won't fix it, yeah, you might switch. But it's going to take a lot once you buy. And that's the way passive investing is. It's a marketing pitch. And it's got intellectual stuff there. It's got specs. But the specs are in themselves not enough. If somebody doesn't buy the emotional marketing pitch, they're not going to go passive. But if they're inclined to go passive, once they buy, and to buy means, you know, put your retirement money in the passive idea. Once you cross that step, you're going to have a hard time ever going rational. Now, if it's only a tiny bit of money, if you only put in $5,000, you might say, what the heck? I mean, you know, you'll switch. If it looks like it's not working, you'll switch. Or if you're somebody who put your money, say you put your money in stocks, or according to the passive idea, back in the year 2000, and you've had 10 years of bad returns, you might say, yeah, this is a loser. I'm not sticking with this. But if you put it in 1980, and from 80 through 2000, you had 20 good years, you're still sticking today. You're maybe a little upset that the last 10 years haven't been so hot, but you're saying, you know, this has always worked. I prided myself on how smart I was. I'm not backing out now. It becomes part of your identity. And I see this everywhere. I see this everywhere. I really think we are a marketing age. We're an age in which people make decisions. People think in marketing terms. This is why somebody said the other day something about teaching people about investing, and he was saying it's a problem in the Twitter age because people only want to look at, you know, what is it on Twitter? You can only enter, I don't know, 120 characters or something. I don't know what it is exactly. And they said you got to reduce everything to a Twitter slogan, you know. And I had somebody say that to me on this. There was a thread that was deleted at the Money Bloggers Network. And one of the guys said, you know, nobody had any arguments. You know, I was citing historical data showing that, you know, the old school safe withdrawal rate studies get the numbers wrong. And they'd say, oh, you know, you've got to reduce that to the amount of characters that can fit on a Twitter or else we're going to ban you, Rob. I'm not going to allow you to talk here. Well, the point is they don't have anything to say on the merits. It's a numerical calculation. How can you oppose it? But you can tell people, oh, sorry, you know, you didn't fit on a Twitter. Now, nobody else has to fit on a Twitter, only Rob Bennett. But, you know, well, that's the way we got to go because there's nothing else to say. Rob Bennett's, he's being unfair. He's being mean. He's using historical data. And, you know, we can't argue with historical data. So we've got to apply the Twitter rule. We've got to have a new rule. It's like that guy at IndexUniverse.com. He applied a rule. He said, Rob, your article meets all the tests for our publication. It's a great article. But for you, we have to have a different rule because you're telling us something we don't want to hear. So for you, you have to mention the Sharpe ratio. Can't publish any articles from you that don't have the Sharpe ratio in it. This is the way it's handled. This is marketing. These decisions aren't being made based on, you know, truth or based on logic or based on reasoning. They're being based on marketing. They don't want to tell people that they've been giving bad advice for 30 years. The evidence that passive investing can never work, it dates back 30 years. And a key component in the marketing of an investing quote-unquote expert is this person has to know things that the average person doesn't know. And the truth of the matter is the average person has common sense. The average person knows not to invest passively. We all know that. We all know that stocks are dangerous when they're insanely priced. But the experts don't know that. The experts believe in 90% of them believe in passive investing. They believe in the efficient market theory. What kind of experts are they? They don't even believe in common sense. They know less than we know. That's the truth. They know they can pass tests and so forth. They know those things. But the tests tell them passive investing works. So what do they know in a final sense? But it's terrible marketing to say that. And I do it all the time. That's my whole deal. I'm all the time saying the experts don't know what they're talking about. Not out of any unkindness or anything like that, but because I think people need to know that. How are we ever going to make the switch from passive to rational if we don't openly acknowledge that passive is wrong? How can you make the transition? Why would you switch models if the first model isn't wrong? You have to explain how dangerous the first model is to move to the new model, the better model. So I have no choice. But it's bad marketing for, you know, if you're Money Magazine and you've been giving the passive advice for 30 years, it's bad marketing to acknowledge, to put out a cover story saying, oh, guess what, money subscribers, we've been giving you bad advice for 30 years. Hey, but we got great advice inside this issue. Buy this issue. Now, it would be true. They could put out a power-packed issue full of wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, they could sell a million copies of that issue. I'm confident because people are desperate for it today. People are desperate for accurate, sensible, realistic investing advice. People want to know what to do with their money, but who's going to do it? Money's been giving bad advice for 30 years. I'm not picking on them. They're just, they've been doing the same as everybody else. But it's bad marketing. And the marketing controls. Marketing controls today. See, it's all about you got to sell products. And this is the fundamental problem with passive investing is that passive investing, the question is, what is passive investing? What is it? And if you talk to one of the advocates, they'll say, oh, passive investing is science. It's science. Science, academic studies. It's not science. If it were science, they'd be open to changing. Science means a quest for truth. Somebody's a true scientist. When he finds he got something wrong, he goes back to the laboratory and he does another test to find out, why did I get that wrong? What is it I misunderstood? Passive investing is the opposite of science. It's the opposite. If it were science, they would have backed off on the dogmatism 30 years ago when the first study came out showing that valuations affect long-term returns. What passive investing is marketing. And there is science. There really is science. That's not a lie. But the science, you see, is being used in the service of a marketing campaign. Why? Because middle-class investors love the idea of investing their money according to science. So take a poll and say, how many of you, I have no doubt but that the marketing people did this on some level. They probably took surveys and they said, what would really make you, you're nervous about investing in stocks. Are you nervous? They could probably start by asking. I don't know. This is all speculation. They probably asked people, why don't you put more money in stocks? I'm talking about this happening in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. Mr. Middle Class Investor, why don't you put more money in stock? What's your stock allocation? Let's start with that. And they say, 20%. 20%. Why don't you have more money in stocks? We sell stocks. We'd like you to have more money in stocks. Why do you only 20%? Scares me. Stocks go down. I don't want to lose my money. Scares me. All right. We're marketing people. We want to know what your emotional hot buttons are. Scares me is an emotional hot button. Thank you for your help. Now I have a follow-up question. Is there anything that anybody could do to make stocks scare you less?
No, they scare me.
All right. They scare you. Here's a multiple choice. Three things. We could do a slogan. I want you to tell me which of these three things would be most likely to persuade you.
Nothing would persuade me. Stocks are too scary.
I understand, but I just want to get your feedback.
All right, I'll give you my feedback, but I know they're too scary. I'm not going to do it.
All right,
All right. One, we could do a marketing campaign in which we would say, Tiger Woods, he invests his money in stocks, 74%. Would that persuade you? No, stocks are too scary. I told you already. Don't you listen? Tiger Woods, no. I like Tiger Woods, but no, too scary. All right. Tiger Woods has more money than me. He can afford to lose money in stocks. I can't. I don't have enough money. All right. All right. That's fair. Thank you for your help. Number two, we can teach you to crush the market. I mean, would that persuade you? No. Sounds stupid. Sounds like something somebody trying to steal all my money would tell me. You know, done with money. Stocks scare me. All right. All right. Throw that one out. There's, you know, we spent $1 million on a campaign to teach people that XYZ mutual fund can teach you how to crush the market, but I guess that's not going to work. Okay. Our last hope. This is some goofball came up with this idea. I sound sort of dumb, but I'm just going to throw it past you. We have scientific evidence that you don't need to change your stock allocation. Scientific evidence, academic studies. Would that persuade you? Oh, I don't know. Stocks are scary. I don't want to put in more than 20%. But if you had scientific evidence, I don't know. Maybe I'd go to 50. I don't know. Maybe. You see, that's where I think this got started, and I'm imagining the whole scenario, but I think it's a marketing. They found out that people wanted to hear that there was science, and they went with that. However they figured it out, whether there was a survey or they just talked to people over dinner or whatever happened, they got this, and they believed it. It's not that, you know, it's, hey, just because people market doesn't mean they're lying to you. The people who came up with the Think Different campaign for Apple, they like Apple Computer. They're not trying to trick me. They think I'd be a fool not to get Apple. The people who came up with this passive investing stuff, they believe. They want you to believe. But they've got to figure out how to do it, or they're out of business. So they learned. Telling people that Tiger Woods likes it, you know, might work with some people, but not most people. People like Tiger Woods, but that's not enough. They're too scared. And telling people they can crush the market, that works with some people too. You know, young people. People that drive 90 miles an hour, you know. But most middle-class people know. But what works with middle-class investors is tell them you've got studies. So this is where the great academic interest in investing began. All of a sudden, you started seeing thousands of studies. And funny little happenstance there, 90% of them supported passive investing. And again, the people doing the studies, they didn't lie. All the calculations check out. If you check them, you'll see. I've looked. But, you know, there's one little problem with passive investing. They ignore valuations. Well, surprise, surprise. All of the studies they did don't include valuations in the methodology. Oh. So when you don't include valuations, you find that valuations don't have an effect. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. And now you can promote the study. So this is all passive investing. It is. At every point on the way, you'll see this. They say, stocks for the long run. Is that true or false? It's true if you wait 30 years. Do they mention that it's going to take 30 years to get your money back after a stock crash? Oh, no. That wouldn't help the marketing pitch. You see? Now, they could say when they're selling Apple Computer, they could say, think different. If they were fully honest, they could say, think different. And as I mentioned, they believe in this. They love Apple. They could say, think different. However, you know, if you think different, the price is that when you need software, there won't be any available because 90% of the software is developed for Windows, not Apple. See, they don't include that in the marketing pitch. If you investigate enough, you could find that out. It's on the internet. You know, you might have to turn to the Windows people to get that, but if you really did your homework, you could find that out. And the same thing's true with passive investing. If you wanted to really do your homework, you could find out that it takes 30 years to get your money back. But it's not a part of the marketing pitch. The marketing pitch is studies. proves it. It all works. Stocks for the long run. That's the marketing pitch. And the fine print is it takes 30 years to get your money back. It's all how you spin it. You know, you can. I'll give another example. I just had a blog, guest blog, where I argued passive investing is a strategy for extremists. Well, that's not the marketing pitch they use. How do they position? You know, this thing called positioning in marketing. They position passive investing as almost a neutral thing. It's like, the very phrase timing doesn't work does this. Why do they always tell you timing doesn't work? Timing doesn't work is idiotic. If timing didn't work, that would mean changing your lowering your allocation when prices were insane wouldn't help you. Does that make any sense at all? Makes zero sense. Zero sense. So how can they say timing doesn't work? They could say timing doesn't work because short-term timing doesn't work. There's studies that show that. If you change your allocation when prices are high and you test, if people did this all through history, are they always ahead at the end of a year? The answer is no. They're sometimes ahead, sometimes behind. It doesn't work. There's no reliability to it. Now, if you check, are they ahead at the end of 5 years or 10 years? Well, yeah, they're always ahead at the end of 5 years or 10 years. But that's the fine print. That's not the marketing slogan. The marketing slogan is timing doesn't work. Why does timing doesn't work? Why is that such a powerful marketing slogan? Because it goes against the idea of get rich quick. What people are trying to do when they're trying to persuade themselves to overinvest in stocks when stocks are insanely overpriced is they want to trick themselves into believing it's not as dangerous as it is, as it must be. Well, timing doesn't work. It almost sounds like you're being prudent. It almost sounds like you're avoiding risky behavior, doesn't it? Timing doesn't work. It's almost like saying speeding doesn't work, you know? Or, you know, unprotected sex doesn't work. You know, it's sort of like an almost imprudent thing. It's the most reckless thing you can do. It's always resulted in bone-crushing losses to ignore price. But it doesn't sound like that. It's a marketing pitch. So, we're living in an age. I don't know. This came up on the Frugal Dad blog the other day. He had a post. It was a very popular post. He called it the Ten Commandments of, I don't know what exactly, Ten Commandments of something, personal finance. And he said, or maybe I'm mixing up two blog posts. I am mixing it up. He had a different, it was a different one. He said, I have enough. That was the title, something like that. And he made this very well done essay where he said, I don't need more. And his point was, you know, it was sort of cut back. You know, cut back, and we're all afraid right now of what's going to happen to us. So a lot of people are looking for that. They want to cut back, and they want an inspirational approach. And it was a good blog entry, and no criticism at all. But I take it a different way, and I put up a different little thing as my comment, and nobody responded to my comment. So I don't think it didn't strike a chord. But I said, I never have enough. I said, my motto is more, better, bigger, bolder. Well, that's passion saving. Passion saving goes against this idea of I have enough. I have enough. Frugality movement is all about. I mean, I don't think it is totally, but the mainstream view is, it's all about I have enough. So you have the consumer societies telling you you don't have enough. You got to spend, and then you got the frugal movement saying you have enough. You don't need any more. But see, I take it different. I what I do is say, I'll never have enough. I'll never have enough. But I look at it as trade-offs. And what I say is, I want more free time. I want time to go running. I want time to build a website. I want time to spend with my wife. I want time to read novels. And how do I get that? By saying no to the junk pitched to me on television. Or by saying no to television itself, throwing it out the window. But I don't say I don't want television because I have enough, or I don't want a, you know, whatever it is, a vacation in Hawaii, whatever it is. I don't say I have enough. What I say is I don't have enough. I don't have enough bike rides. So by cutting out the Hawaii vacation, I get 1,000 bike rides, and I actually do the calculations, you know, to figure it out, and that reinforces me. But my point here is just the different ideas are competing at a marketing level. The consumer society's marketing itself, the society, the viewpoint telling you to spend, that's done by marketing. And the frugal people are marketing. It's just anti, you know, it's saying don't spend. You know, you're so virtuous if you don't spend. You're so good. And I'm not saying either one is wrong. I think there's truth in both positions. And I believe there's truth. If you really want to take this to its limit, I believe there's truth in the passive investing position. It's marketing, but that doesn't mean there's not powerful truth there. The idea that you'll be ahead at the end of 30 years is a powerful insight. So there's good stuff, you know, involved. But my concern is the marketing pitch takes it away, you know, and sort of poisons it. But I'm just making a different marketing pitch on saving. I'm saying save not because you want to cut back. Save because you want more. And I think that's a more powerful pitch in the long run. I think telling people to cut back, it might work in a scary environment like this where people say, well, I need to cut back or, you know, I'm going to be doomed. But this scary environment isn't going to last forever. And if you only cut back for a couple of years, you're not going to get the big benefits. I feel like I can go for life with the idea of I want more. That's never going to stop. That's human nature. So I advocate saving not to cut back, but to get more. And I think that's more in accord with human nature. And as I say, the same thing with stock investing. I advocate changing the way you invest, not out of fear, not really to avoid bear markets. I advocate it because you'll get more money. This is what I've been saying from the first day, May 13th, 2002. The reason I lower my allocation at times of insane prices is then when prices drop, I've got more money to put into stocks when they're selling at good prices. So I end up owning a lot more stocks than the passive investing advocates over the course of a lifetime. There's these little time periods, you know, 5 years where I have less. So what? My point is to own more over the course of my lifetime, and I do. If you look at the calculators, it shows that. You'll end up owning more stocks if you're willing to look at valuations. But if you rule that out, if you're passive, you'll end up owning less stocks. So who's the real stock lover? So what my point here is, it's a marketing battle. We're living in a marketing age, and most of our thought is conducted through marketing sort of, through a marketing process. Everybody's trying to get your attention with a different message, and they're all summing up their pitch in 5 words or less, a marketing slogan. You know, timing doesn't work. Stocks for the long run. Buy and hold. Stay the course. It's all marketing pitches. If you like those marketing pitches, you know, I don't think they should be banned. I think they should permit the marketing pitches. It's up to people to decide which marketing pitch to go with. But I guess the thing that I would say is these marketing pitches are dangerous because they're so powerful. And there's no marketing pitch. It's really an incredibly powerful marketing pitch that the passive investing people have going for them. This idea that they have science. That, you know, the modern man loves science. And it's a betrayal of science to call this stuff science. I have respect for science. That's part of the reason I find passive investing so offensive. Because they claim science, and then you say, well, why didn't you look at this factor? And they say, you're insane. You know, we have to ban you from our board because you're asking about the methodology. And if you ask about the methodology, our marketing pitch doesn't work anymore. Now, big picture, what I really think is going on is I don't think this is just going on in the investing area. I don't know about other areas because I don't study them. I can only speak to what I've studied. I've seen it in the investing area, and it amazed me. It's amazed me what I've learned. It's amazed me. But it's hard for me to believe this is only going on in the investing area. And I did a podcast just a few back about Lyme disease and how I think some of that applies with Lyme. And I don't know if the parallel in the marketing is exact, but the problem, it seemed, from the book I read online, it's called Cure Unknown by Pamela Weintraub. Very good book on Lyme. If you're worried about Lyme, it's a good book to read.
you know, my conclusion from reading the book is that the primary problem was managed care. And I don't know if I'd call managed care, you know, a marketing thing exactly, but there was a marketing element to it. It was, managed care was marketed. It was reduced to slogans. It was reduced to an emotional take. And the emotional take was essentially, you know, lots of people are ripping off the healthcare system, and we need to rein that in. We need to reduce cost, and we don't want to deny people, so we have to sort of come up with treatment programs and have these, you know, layers of approval. And it was sort of like a, let's not waste money. You know, we'll all be better off if the doctor doesn't have total power to decide what your treatment is, that other people have to approve it. And it's a pretty powerful marketing pitch. Trouble. What we're discovering with Lyme is that marketing doesn't always work. It's a big problem. Because now, you know, the old way was the doctor looked at the patient and the doctor cared about the patient and the doctor would do something to help. And that, like, the you know, one of the things the gatekeepers have, they when all, you know, all these people are saying they have Lyme and they can't be treated, and the gatekeepers have to give some answer. Well, why are there so many thousands of people saying they have Lyme if they don't have it? And they're saying, well, those people are crazy. Those people are crazy. But see, your doctor wouldn't be able to do that. Your doctor would know whether you were crazy or not. I mean, if you really were a crazy person, your doctor would have a history to go by, and he'd say, well, I'm not going to give you the treatment because I'm not so sure. But the doctors know these people aren't crazy if they know them, if they're regular patients. And so you've got this disconnect now. The people deciding what the treatment is going to be are not the same people who are seeing the patient. And that causes problems. And in the case of Lyme, where we don't really understand at all, we don't understand, well, a lot we don't understand, it's caused a huge problem of people being denied treatment, which means the disease has progressed and spread more than it would have had we treated it more effectively. Does that mean managed care is always bad? I don't think so. But I do think it shows a weakness in the managed care marketing pitch, if you want to call it that. I don't think the parallel here is perfect, but I do think there's some parallel. And the passive thing, a lot of it is gold. A lot of it, the idea of using science to learn about investing, I think is gold. As long as you keep it, you know, you don't overanalyze, you don't have overconfidence in your conclusions. In other words, you have to sort of handle it in a restrained way. And my guess is that a lot of the researchers did just that. In other words, if you look at the original studies, you will find they had all kinds of caveats. But once the mutual fund companies got a hold of it, the caveats go by the wayside. They're buried in footnote 643. And, you know, timing doesn't work is in big, bold letters. And stocks for the long run is in big, bold letters. And buy and hold and stay the course. It's the marketing slogans that are influencing middle-class investors. Marketing triumphs over science. That's what it comes down to. And science is actually part of the market. It's not even that marketing triumphs over science. Science is working for the marketing pitch. They're actually using science to make unscientific claims. Claims that are not supported by the historical data. And so, as a society, we're going to have to decide, are we going to continue? Now, what's, you know, I won't go into all the rest, but in this particular case, it caused an economic crisis. I can take that through step by step how that happened. I've done it on earlier podcasts, but I can only do one thing on each podcast. But at some point, we're all going to have to sit back and say, wait a minute, do we want to destroy our economy? Or are we willing to acknowledge making a mistake, overselling this passive investing idea? But that is real hard because it goes against the marketing pitch. It's like a self-contained world. Once marketing becomes dominant, every bit of advice you give has to fit in that marketing pitch or it has to be rejected. And I'm really totally, without having intended to go down this road, I feel I'm creating a whole new model because I'm saying, the true experts are the ones who can stand up and say, I got some things wrong. Those are the ones I respect the most. Because then I trust them that they have to use marketing. I can't tell you they shouldn't use marketing because you got to make a living. You can't make a living today without some marketing. But I want to hear the ones who say, I can admit getting something wrong. Because if they can do that, I feel we can work with that. You know, Michael Kitsis is an example. You know, I've had interactions with him and, you know, a Maryland financial planner. And there were some times when I felt he wasn't willing to state all of what he believed. You know, he held things back because of marketing considerations. But he was always friendly and he was always polite and kind. And I think that's about the best you can hope for. You know, if you get that, we can find our way out of this mess over time. But when you get hostility, it shuts everything down. And the big passive investing advocates right now are still at the hostility stage, or at best at the indifferent stage, but some are actually at the hostility stage. And we have to get past that. But we have to start realizing that when you hear things being promoted, it doesn't mean, and they say science, they might be using the word science as a marketing pitch. Science sells, that's all. And it's true, as I say, it's not just true in investing. It's true globally. It's true. Magazine articles, you know, they'll try to come up with scientific things. I mean, one of the questions I wrote here in my notes is financial journalism marketing? Is the whole thing marketing? I mean, Money Magazine, I know. I know I saw this. They were looking for somebody. They were going to do an article, I think, on somebody who retired early. And they said, you know, submit your facts, you know, what your story is, and submit a picture. You know, in other words, which story they're going to run depends on what the person looks like. Now, they've got to sell magazines, you know, they've got to make a living. I don't fault them, really. But, obviously, it's a little disturbing that one of the primary considerations is what does the person look like. Whereas if it was pure journalism, what would matter is, you know, how compelling is the story? The story in a marketing age, and I think we're in a marketing age, the marketing is top. You know, marketing dominates. Marketing controls what you read and what you don't read. And what, as I say, one of the marketing things is you got to reduce it to a Twitter. And if your story's a little too complicated for a Twitter, you can't get it in. So I think. If we don't overcome this, I don't want to do away with the marketing personally. I think the marketing has a good side. But I think we have to rein it in. So what happens in society is different forces assume different levels of influence, and then the society responds and reins them in. And if it reins them in properly, the society goes on to bigger and better things. You know, we'll always have marketing, but it will never become so totally dominant again, and we'll at least be able to hear different stories, and some of us will invest passively, and some will invest rationally, and maybe there'll be some new school developed, you know, that's a mix, who knows. We'll survive. But if we don't face the issue that marketing is now dominant, and for 30 years we have not told people the truth about stock investing, as we know from the academic research, if we continue to deny people access to that knowledge, I think the economy goes over a cliff. So I think this is important. It might seem silly. Oh, you know, it's just a marketing thing. That's not that important. No, the marketing is dominating the substance today. We can't discuss substance because people feel it would mess up their marketing message. And I, you know, if you want to look at a really global interpretation, I'd say the purpose of an economic crisis is to take us and force us to look at these things. We've put it off for 30 years. We don't want to do it as a people. And if we don't do it, we're going to drive the economy off a cliff. There's going to come a point at which the pain's going to be so great that we're all going to say, well, you know what? I don't care anymore about the marketing pitch. I just want to find the truth about stock investing. That's what I care about. And then we've got the intellectual knowledge, the science, to turn this around overnight. If we could just tell people how stock investing works, we could restore confidence in the market, restore confidence in the economy, restore confidence in our political system. But can we do it? That remains to be seen. Because I lean towards the triumph of the optimist school, I think we'll do it. But there's a lot of evidence. We're not going to do it unless we're absolutely forced. We're not going to do it because somebody puts up words on a discussion board.
we're going to have to suffer a real, real serious pain to get there. My hope is that we'll suffer that pain quickly enough that we turn it around before the car goes over the cliff. Because once it goes over the cliff, it's a lot harder to recover. You know, things get out of control at that point, and who knows where we end up. My take, on the marketing aspect of all this, please let me know if you have thoughts. Use that Contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.